Can I have a mic? Good. I'll call the Joint Special Committee on Healthcare Transformation to order. Our first order of business is to move into a bill, the LC we have in front of us. That will allow us to send staff running off to the Chief Clerk's office, where it will be printed in the next 15 minutes and read on the floor for first reading tomorrow, so we'll have an actual bill in front of us when next we meet. So I will ask for a work session.
Chair Greenlick.
Yes, ma'am.
I move that LC 4105, dated 4/2011, be introduced as a committee bill.
Co-chair moves that LC 4105, dated 4/2011, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll? Here, over there. Yes. Thanks, Joe.
Representative
Kotek. Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Morse.
Aye.
Co-Chair Freeman.
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlick.
Aye.
Co-Chair Montes Anderson.
Aye.
What's the bill number?
Motion carries, and LC 4105 is on the way to the Chief Clerk's office.
Oh, it's going to be a new bill?
Okay. It will be a new bill. Do we know a number?
Not yet.
Okay.
Let's keep it a secret for as long as we can.
I think the secret's leaked out. So. I think where we're going to go today is going to ask Lori Freeman and the two representatives of the governor to join us and ask Lori to walk through LC 4105 for us. Something for members of the committee. I'm passing down an article that was done on community health work as a part of a project that I did in the 70s. And we'll give an example of what we're going to be talking about later when we talk about community health workers. Thank you, guys. Lori, before we start, we need to tell you how much we appreciate the extraordinary amount of work you did to get this thing ready for us. Over all sorts of confused instructions coming from all quarters until we finally settle down on the governor's version of this bill.
So. We have a new idea.
Yeah, all the amendments to the bill now.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Lori Freeman, Office of Legislative Counsel, and I'm just going to sort of briefly fly through this. What I tried to do is take the legislative concept that I got and first organize it so to eliminate a lot of the redundancies that are in it, overlapping sections, duplicative sections, and then second, to try to incorporate it into the current scheme of the Oregon Revised Code rather than creating whole new sections. So I'm just going to quickly...
Lori, excuse me just a moment.
There's a lot of...
Let me find out how the committee would like to handle it. How would you like to handle comments or questions? Would you like it to go straight through and then come back and ask questions, or what's your pleasure?
My suggestion is we let her get through it without a bunch of interruption, and then we can start working it. If not, we'll be here for 10 hours.
Great. Then we'll let you go all the way through, unless somebody has a very brief... clarification question you need. I'm sorry. Maybe that'll be the last interruption.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the beginning of it is the whereas clauses, which are pretty much verbatim from the LC document I had. On page 3, I've amended ORS 414018, which talks about, which was actually enacted originally for the Oregon Health Plan with the intent of the Oregon Health Plan. And incorporated the language regarding coordinated care organizations. And I think this is going to be very important because a lot of the subsequent sections are not exactly very concrete. I think there's a lot of vagueness in it. So I think this first section will be important for not only the agency interpreting the statutes, but also any courts that might have to interpret. And section two, I've amended 414620, which is where we the Oregon Healthcare Cost Containment System, and now we have the Oregon Integrated and Coordinated Healthcare Delivery System. The real meat of it comes in section four on page six, which is where you get to what the criteria is for the coordinated care organizations. And then the following sections are sort of the supporting sections. You have in section five on page nine, the alternative payment methodologies, which aren't really prescribed, but just some general guidelines for coming up with the methodologies. Section six, patient-centered primary care homes. A thrust of this is that the coordinated care organizations should strive to the extent possible to use primary care, patient-centered primary care homes. Section seven is where we're incorporating in the dual eligibles, the people who qualify for both Medicaid and Medicare. And later on we ask, we require the department to try to get federal approval so that we can serve the dual eligible population in the coordinated care organizations. I just wanted to point out this section seven, subsection three also has a protection for anyone who's currently enrolled in a PACE program. It says they can stay in it, or if someone wants to move into a PACE program, they can. Section 8 is sort of protections for both consumers, mainly consumers, but also providers who are working through coordinated care organizations. And I'm not going to go into detail on this. Most of it comes right out of the draft. Section 9 is the quality measures, which was an important component, but again, it doesn't specify what they are, but it says that the Oregon Health Authority has to go through a public process to try to establish these quality measures, and then gives some criteria and says that they have to be published. And Section 10 requires the health authority to adopt competency and quality measures for these new types of health care providers that are appear throughout this this bill. The community health workers, personal health navigators, and peer wellness specialists. And when you move on, we've amended the 414.025, which is the definition section for Chapter 414, to include a definition for community health workers that have been provided to me, a personal health navigator that I found online. But I left open peer wellness specialist because I don't know what that is. So it's intentionally blank in this bill, so you can tell me what you're thinking. Section 11 is protected information, and this is just to make sure that any protected health information remains, although it can be used within the coordinated care organizations and between the organizations and the providers in the organizations, it's still confidential and can't be shared outside of the need for providing health care and treatment. Section 12 is where I sort of lumped all the transitional provisions. There was a lot of ideas that were just temporary, and rather than putting them in statute and then having to repeal them or just having them there forever, I put them all into a transitional section, which is later repealed. And in subsection 2, this is on page 15, It specifies that the health authority has to develop qualification criteria and present it to the appropriate interim committees of the Legislative Assembly no later than October 3rd, 2011. And that's just a placeholder for whatever the committee decides they want to be the form of legislative approval. Same with subsection 3. This is the global budgeting process, which also has to be presented for legislative approval, and that I just left blank. But in the meantime, until that's approved, then the rest of subsection 3 sets out what the interim global budgeting process should be, and it mirrors what currently exists in ORS 414.741, which requires an independent actuary to come up with a benchmark global budget, and it lays out all the criteria and factors they have to consider. And then it says that whatever global budget the Oregon Health Authority comes up with, if it differs from what the benchmark is, then that same actuary who did the benchmark has to determine whether or not it's viable. And then on page 18, we're still in the transitional section. Beginning on line 5, subsection 4 says that contracts that are in existence with prepaid managed care, health services organizations are to be amended to allow them to become coordinated care organizations. And then subsection 5 delays the transition for dental care organizations and the reimbursement process for rural hospitals. And then I think really the rest of it, rest of the bolded section is sort of things the department thought they needed as sort of legal authority to follow through. So we have section 13 is, you know, cooperation between DHS or Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. Section 14 is all the federal approvals they're going to have to seek out. Section 15, page 20, exemption from antitrust laws, and this is just to prevent these organizations, to allow the organizations to work together but not be subject to antitrust. And then beginning on 16 are the statutes that I amended that were not simply conforming. They might have had a substantive piece, so I didn't put them in the conforming amendment section, but I put them ahead of that. And this just, the first one amends 413.032, which are the duties of the Oregon Health Authority. And in subsection 1B, which begins on line 25 of page 21, I took out the developing a plan for the health insurance exchange only because they did that already. And if even if the bill doesn't go through at this point, I guess it would be the Fed's version of it anyways. But adding that the Oregon Health Authority is responsible for the Oregon Integrated and Coordinated Healthcare Delivery System. Also on page 22, the policies for expanding the workforce. And then on page 23, this is where I amended the definition section for chapter 414 to add in the new defined term. And I also integrated the definition of health services that appears in 414.705 into this section so that we would have one definition section for the whole chapter. Section 18 all the way on page 31 is agreements with the federal government authorizes the department or the Oregon Health Authority to enter into agreements with the federal government, including with respect to the dual eligible Medicare and Medicaid people. Section 19 amends the Section 19 mainly is cleanup of of language to make it, to bring it up to 2011 and put it in plain English. But it also, it's important because it allows the department, or the, why do I want to keep calling it department? The Oregon Health Authority to establish outcome and quality measures for one, and also to establish alternative payment methodologies. Section 20 and Section 21 put the peer wellness, the community health workers and the personal health navigators into the Home Care Commission and give them collective bargaining rights. Section 22, we have a current section 414-153, which already talks about the partnering between the Oregon Health Authority and counties and the provision of health care services. So I just inserted some of the stuff that was in the draft that wasn't covered in this section into this section.
Makes sense.
414.712, which is section 23 beginning on page 37. This adds that people who are in coordinated care organizations get ombudsman services. And in the draft, there had been a separate section saying that they could have ombudsman services, but I just inserted it into the current statute. Section 24, beginning on page 38, which is just the authority of the authority to enter into contracts with the coordinated care organizations. Makes those contracts not subject to the public contracting provisions for the most part. Section 25, beginning on page 42, amends ORS 414.737 just to say that the people who used to have to enroll in prepaid managed care health services organizations now have to enroll in coordinated care organizations. And then page 44 is just a double amend of that same statute. It has a delayed operative date.
That's why it's twice.
Yeah, sometime in the future it's going to be amended, and so you have to amend both versions. Section 27, ORS 414.760, beginning on page 45, just requires coordinated care organizations, to the extent practicable, to offer patient-centered primary care homes. And section 28 at the bottom of that page expands the data collection of the Oregon Health Policy and Research to allow them to get data from all of the licensing boards in order to assess the healthcare workforce in the state. Section 29 isn't really a substantive change. It's just, this is page 46, because we had incorporated the definition of health services into 414.025, we had to change the citation on line 26. Section 30 is the what's currently the Medicaid managed care assessment. And so this was just converted to the coordinated care organization assessment. No other substantive changes to it. And then 48 to the end is all the conforming amendments.
Bruce, would you, Mike, like to comment before we get questions from the floor? What's your pleasure?
Happy to make some very brief comments. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, director of the Oregon Health Authority. First and foremost, I want to echo what Chair Greenlick said about Lori and Lynch drafting of this. I think it's a fantastic job of taking a lot of information and getting it to a place that we can all talk about it. I think it's done a great job of setting a framework that really took the work of the last 8 weeks plus Wednesday nights that everybody on the dais and about 40 some odd other people were a part of, and begins to really take some of that and put it into a format that we can work with as legislation. I think it provides the right balance of some definition about where we're going in terms of creating coordinated care organizations and what that means and establishing them, and at the same time providing, I think, two other pieces, which is one, some ability for us as the agency to do some more work, which clearly has to be done in terms of providing greater definition both around what these organizations are, will be, as well as the budgeting for them, and then requires us to come back to the legislature for final sign-off and approval. So I think it does a great job in doing that. We've had the bill for probably a little less than 24 hours now, and so really commenting on a lot of the sections, haven't really had the ability to go through each and every one in the detail sort of sufficient, but at a first quick read, I think it does a great job. The one piece I guess I would point out that I think warrants some additional discussion is the whole notion of a transitional period. And I think from our standpoint, it would make a lot of sense to continue and extend our current structure for the Oregon Health Plan with our current managed care organizations until we actually establish and get sign-off on coordinated care organizations and then move to that as a structure rather than creating a transitional structure that could be, I think, fairly ephemeral, and that would require a lot of work for what could be a very short period of time. So with that as sort of a caveat and a sense that there's certainly a lot of details to work out, I think it's a great step.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Mike Bonetto with the Governor's Office. I would certainly echo Bruce's comments and many thanks to Lori for her work. I know that was not an easy job, but I do think that a lot of our work over the last 8 to 10 weeks has been captured here. I do want to highlight, I think it's an important piece. I think the Governor definitely wanted to make sure that this was emphasized even this evening. On this transitional provision, and as Lori was going through this, it's on page 15, section 12. And I think that the big policy issue is, what does that legislative check-off, sign-off look like? And I think, you know, we're really looking at this from two counts. You know, one being an approval of the CCO criteria and qualifications, and the other being the global budgeting process. And I think from the governor's perspective, it's been pretty clear that both of those have to go together, that you can't have a CCO without a global budget. And so a lot of the language that's in here is based on having a CCO without a global budget, and how would you actually create that budget. And we're saying, you know, that probably can be eliminated because they have to go hand in hand. And I think that's really going to be up to the legislature in terms of how that sign-off goes and then, you know, handing it off to the authority. But I think for right now, the plan is much like has been discussed with Senate Bill 99. We have some broad framework around CCO criteria that still needs to be developed and a lot of work that needs to be developed on how we get to a global budget that would then come back for legislative approval.
Okay, let's open it up. Start down here on my left. Would somebody like to ask some questions first before laying things on the table?
Can you sort of start at the beginning?
Okay, start at the beginning, go through sections and get,
yeah,
and get comments from each of us.
Just see if there's any burning issues from the, from
okay.
the committee.
Let's do that.
Section 1, page 3.
Yes.
Oh, he has
a
if we're starting at the beginning, how about line 1 or line 2? The relating clause, does that give us enough leeway to put a section in on tort reform?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Thompson, I don't think it does. And I actually consulted with Dave Hendricks on this. We just couldn't find a way to argue that tort reform would fit into health. And even if you could come up with a way to shoehorn it in, I think it would be, it would make the whole bill subject to a legal challenge, and probably a really good legal challenge, that the basis, on the basis that it wasn't within the title.
So it makes you wonder why we didn't use health care instead of health.
Yeah.
Representative Greenlee, Representative Thompson, health care, it wouldn't fit in health care either.
Medical
Chair,
liability.
Healthcare costs?
Well, it's going to be hard to change the relating clause now without getting a whole new bill.
We need a new bill then. I really think that's going to be a huge problem going to talk about cost containment.
We could have a parallel bill that goes with it as a package.
Yeah. That would have a dubious fate on our side.
Yes, it would.
Mr. Chair, that's the problem on the Senate side. That becomes problematic. But, or maybe not, I don't know.
Time to get it.
We might.
What sort of relating clause would it need to allow tort reform be included in the rest of the substance of this bill?
Another bill. Relating to medical liability would work. Mr. Chair, I might suggest we draft another new bill and we can tie the two together.
They have two bills that we tie as a package. Yeah, that's what I was suggesting.
With a poison pill.
So.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me?
With a poison pill provision.
One doesn't pass.
One doesn't pass.
Well, I think we can have agreements on that.
Maybe, Mr. Chair, we at some point tonight we go into work session and make that request.
Mr. Chair.
Actually, we don't need to make that request. We could ask. I mean, we don't need to be in work session.
That's true.
We simply ask for a bill on tort reform that's completely blank, right? For the relating clause.
Mr. Chair.
And a panel, right? I know how to get those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With all due respect to my colleagues, do we have a proposal that you're particularly suggesting? Because we had one conversation at the Wednesday night meetings.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a straw proposal out for a couple weeks now. Clock is ticking. I would prefer that we move ahead with this and we can look at a companion bill, but I'd like to see some language on what people are thinking, because if this is indeed an integrated thing that some people feel we can't move without the other, we need to start seeing what you're actually talking about. So, and you might have that discussion on the Senate side. We have not had the discussion on the House side, as far as I'm concerned.
Representative, I'd be happy to have that discussion with you.
That would be great. No, with the committee. Not with me, with the committee.
Next week, we can bring
that
a proposal.
We actually had two proposals in the Health Committee. One sort of from the OMA and one from the trial lawyers. That might be something we want to look at to get started.
I just think we have to be intentional about it, colleagues. We're on a tight timeline. And I might not share the urgency of that issue, but I do share the urgency of finishing the bill. So.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Well, maybe I can add to the urgency of the tort reform discussion. It will have to be a part of a package that passes through here for me to be excited about doing anything.
I think you've heard the same thing from me. The Senate Republicans.
Well, not just the Senate Republicans.
Mr. Chair, this was a part of those discussions on Wednesday night. It was constantly brought up over and over again that tort reform had to be part of transformation.
Yeah.
It's not in this bill. Maybe it can't be in this bill, but it can be hooked to this bill. If this bill passes, the other passes, or vice versa. It's your poison pill. And I think most of us have a pretty clear idea what
we'd like to see. Probably the Oregon Tort Act would probably be appropriate, but we're going to have a discussion with the committee. As time goes along here, we'll bring something forward rather quickly.
But let me suggest that we get a bill with tort reform as the relating to clause with anything you want in paragraph one. And then if we could each circulate and say we had at least one bill in the House that we were holding to think about this discussion, and I had another proposal that came to me from the trial lawyers, which is similar to the one in the House, let me get those two copies to all of us and anybody else that has a proposal. Let's get that copy to all of us so we can have some pieces in front of us that we can look at when Tim takes over at the next session. So we can be working on, I think the agreement is here, we'll be working on two parallel bills that will go together as a package. We're not. Whatever we agreed to.
And I apologize if I'm coming late to this discussion, but is the intention that some kind of tort reform as it relates to individuals who will be served by the by the CCOs, i.e. folks on the health plan? Are we talking globally for the entire...
medical liability.
For Oregon health plan recipients served by CCOs.
For Medicaid dual eligibles.
It had to be...
Or dual eligibles.
It had to be global.
It's got to be global.
Otherwise, you just cost shift.
We might not have agreement on that, so we...
Well, that's why we vote on things.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Any more questions on the page before the first page?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I am going to want to take a hard look at the sections that this bill repeals. There may be a poison pill or two in there.
What section is that you're talking about?
I'm looking at right below page one. Actually, it's lines 8 and 9. It repeals a whole bunch of ORSs, and I'm going to want to look and see actually what we're repealing. The rest of it's amending, but... Huh?
Chair?
Yes, sir.
One of those that I'd like to flag for discussion is 414.742. That has to do with the capitation on the psychiatric drugs. And that's going to be a hot issue for some people.
Yep. I'm sorry, 414...
414.742. It's at the end of line 9.
Mr. Chair, also on the very last page is where the sections that actually repeal the sections and the effective date on page 71.
There, at the end of the... Okay, anything else pre-section 1?
Mr. Chair,
because my poison pill is in section 1.
Mr. Chair, on the items that could possibly, the comment about the ORSs that could be repealed, are we volunteering a committee staff to do that review? Is there a staff member who has a staff person who can help with that review? Is that LC's job to do the review? What's the pleasure of the chair?
I think each individual ought to be looking at things that cause them heartburn. They're specified in the border plan, is that right, what those sections are? Is that what you said?
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Did you say you specified what was deleted on the last page?
Yes, page 71, section 58. Some of the things have a delayed repeal.
I would say with everything else, anybody... should have at it. All right, section 1. Anybody have questions of section 1?
Mr. Chair, what's the binding nature of the whereas clauses?
None.
Will you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, if something was ambiguous, a court could look at the whereas clauses in order to try to interpret an ambiguous statute, or even if it wasn't ambiguous, if the statute seemed contrary to what the expressed intent was, the court could consider that as well. But it would be pretty far down the line in terms of analyzing the meaning of a statute.
I just, thank you. I was just wondering how much time we should spend wordsmithing the whereas clause.
No, I was in the next page.
But I do have a question to the bill.
Go for it. And the whereas clause?
On line 27-28, when it says individuals who are fully eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, there'll be some that are just who are Medicaid. I mean, but we don't, they need to be Medicare and Medicaid is one section, and then Medicaid is, because the way it is now, it's Medicare. And we are including all Medicare.
I'm sorry, which whereas are you talking
page
to?
Page 3, line...
Oh, yeah, we're still on whereases.
Huh.
I just wanted to make sure everybody was clear on whereas. Okay, you're on line 3, section 1, and...
No, page 3, lines 27... We are covering Medicaid and dual eligibles, and is that what it says? We don't want all of Medicare in here, just the dual eligibles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss Anderson, it says there you have to be fully eligible for both, so it would only be the dual eligibles.
And that's what that means. Okay, thank you.
Lori, can I ask why you deleted the only statutory statement giving us the goal of universal access out of the Oregon statutes in line 4, 5, and 6?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the draft I was given had it included as a whereas clause. So you'll find it, go back to page 1, on lines 11 through 13.
Which has no standing, as opposed to a statutory statement, which has standing.
Has less standing, that is correct.
Speak about what might be hard to pass. I might be hard to accept a bill that takes out the only statement we have in all of the statutes that gives us a goal of moving toward universal access. It was a basic part of the introduction to the Oregon Health Plan to begin with. And it seems to me it's symbolically extraordinarily important, and particularly important when you start a transformation bill by saying we no longer have a statutory goal to have universal access to health care. So I suppose as we get amendments proposed, you can propose an amendment to not strike out a section as a piece of it. Okay. Malpractice is
noted.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I tried to adhere as closely as possible to the draft that was given me. So.
I hear you. Anything else on section 1?
No, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
whereas,
sir.
Line 12, page 2.
Page 2?
Yeah, I'm not
back
sure.
To the whereas.
Right, I'm not sure what most effective component is. Some thought might be given to definition.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, this is pretty much word for word what I was given, so you might have to ask whoever drafted that what that means.
Oh, yeah, we're not sure who did that. So that's a little... One thing, we may get a proposal simply delete all the whereases if there's nothing in them that makes a difference. And then we won't have to wordsmith it.
I would support that.
I would too.
Idea, Mr. Chair.
All right, will you start keeping track of amendments that we're going to ask for?
What needs to be relevant should be in the bill. Yeah.
Okay. We have consensus. If not,
well,
unanimity.
Tina, I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
Notice, Senator Cruz and I have agreed.
Yeah. Senator Cruz and I agree on a major health care bill.
Actually, makes twice, I think.
I think so,
okay. Okay. We have anything else on Section 1 that we want to ask about?
Mr. Chair, I just question the wisdom of putting in the statute on line 4, or excuse me, page 4, line 24 and 25. I just raised that as a question.
So there's a question about, Rick, are you scribing where we're going? That would be really helpful if you could note
the things that are questioned by who does it, and then we can look the whole thing over again. That would be very helpful. So we're talking about line 24 and 25, a part of 3B. It is 3B under something else, under G, I guess. Anyway, lines 24 and 25 on page 4. Okay, anything else in section 1 that we want to ask about or comment on? Section 2? Any questions on section 2?
There's a chair line on page 5, lines 22 and 23. This goes to the heart of what we're trying to do here. Call out global budgets. My question, I have read only through this twice, and so I might miss something here. Let's say you arrive at a global budget for a coordinated care organization, and they fail their budget. Who's responsible? Who takes the risk? Who takes care of the individuals they are contracting with that don't get paid? Where's the risk? Where's the reserves?
There is a section later that has one of the criteria of naming a critical care organization. They have an assessment on who is responsible for the risk. I don't know exactly what it is, but Bruce, you have a comment on that?
Senator Bates, co-chairs, members of the committee. There is a section later on that talks about having the appropriate, establishing rules to have the appropriate solvency to assure that the scenario that you outlined doesn't happen. And I think that that's exactly what we envisioned in developing the global budget. It's not simply developing how do you establish the global budget, but then what are the criteria around who takes risks for that, what does that mean, what is solvency, how will that be determined. And I think those are some of the things that clearly there needs to be a lot of attention to, because that's going to matter quite a bit, and that we'll come back to the legislature to sign off on.
So the idea is established by rule, but have us come back for sign-off probably before February or during the February.
Correct. And I think in its most basic form, the sense was to have coordinated care organizations that can take risk for an amount, in essence, that becomes a per capita amount in a budget, but certainly not to take risk for changes in enrollment, as we've seen in over the past 2 years, in dramatic increases in enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan. And so not having organizations who, quote, have a global budget and then are asked to care for even more people within that budget. And those are some of the things that need to get worked out.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Where does transparency? I feel all of the coordinated care organizations' budgets have to be very transparent, where we know where their money is actually going.
I believe there's something in there on that, but
okay.
We're all looking for it.
If it's there, that's fine.
There's actually a place that says you can't make it transparent. That's one of the things I noted.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I did mark on the first draft, and I can't find it. It would be appropriate, to create a section called financial reporting, and in that section deal with all of the issues with respect to audits, transparency, and the financial status, so that we have a very, very clear understanding of where this money is going, how it's being used.
Can I suggest we focus on the sections in front of us and make notes about what we want to make sure we have, and then when we get to the end, we can ask, we didn't find this, and let's see if we find it. So is there anything else on section 2?
I've got a couple more just real quickly.
Let's go.
Page 7, 25 to 20. I mean, I'm going to what I consider the key parts of this bill.
That's section 3 you're going to now?
No, that's
section
2. Did I jump over a section? I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's see anybody else on section 2.
Never mind.
Let's go to section 3, which is, what is section 3?
Short.
The two-line section. What is it? What does it do?
Chair Greenlake, it adds these subsequent sections to the chapter so that they pick up the definitions of 414025.
Okay. Senator Bates is on section 4. You're on lines on page 7. What line, Senator Bates?
25 to 28. Just a couple of questions real quickly. This talks about coordinated care and a contractual relationship with the mental health and public health authorities. You may want to add A and D, alcohol and drugs, the major component of what they'll be working with. And maybe somewhere else in the bill, I just missed it. And the other part of this is, which may include a role in governance.
Do you have it at that point?
No, I had A and D.
It is somewhere else already.
Go ahead.
Is it somewhere else already, Rick? I missed it.
I just want to make sure he's noting the things you're saying.
And then there's a very interesting phrase, which may include a role in governance. This is one of the places where we have, I think, some difficulty for coordinated care organizations when they have to deal with a mental health group inside a county or an AED group, and having some control over what's going on inside that, just more than just a contractual relationship. And so I assume that means. It gives them an opportunity to step into the organization and say, we'll contract with you, but we have to have some idea what's going on inside your organization, and may even have to go to the point of stepping in and having some kind of governance there. Am I reading this correctly? I think it's appropriate. I just want to make sure I'm reading it properly.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Anybody else?
Well, Mr. Chair, and it isn't right here, but but it's before and it's after, and I've looked in definitions. I can't find a definition for global budget.
There is a section on global budget. Let's see if we make any sense.
But is there a definition for global budget?
I think section is all mixed up anyway, so.
Well, it is. I mean, we keep talking global, then we talk Medicaid, which isn't global, and I'm confused.
Well, they're clearly talking about a Medicaid global budget. But even then, section is a little confused, and when we get to it, I think we'll have it. It obviously needs some work.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, there's a definition of alternative payment mechanism, and global budget is one of an alternative payment mechanism. And then later on, it requires the authority to establish criteria for the global payment. Okay. So since it's yet to be determined, it's not defined.
That's why I couldn't find it. Okay.
Okay, where are we?
Page 8, Mr. Chair.
Page 8, go ahead.
We're talking about every coordinated care organization needs to have a community advisory council. And in there, which includes representatives of the community and of county government. And I was wondering why, I mean, I will want the advocates for this to explain the reasoning for county government.
Because that's where all the services come from.
Yeah, I know. A lot of the services are there. And so just a little bit for the advocates need to make sure that this is meeting the needs, but I'd like an explanation of what that really means.
Senator Freeman, do you have a comment?
I was just going to comment that in some areas, county government's very involved in healthcare delivery services. In some areas, it's not. So we may want to somehow word that. If you got skin in the game, you're involved. If you want to step out of it and let somebody else do it, you can.
Do you all have a comment on county government? Maybe we'll get somebody from county government later to talk to us. But do you? No comment?
I think it's one of the sections we wanted to be able to look a little bit more closely.
Great.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
On that note, back on page 7 on line 25 and 26, I would just look for some feedback on what a formal contractual relationship means. To what end, I guess, is my question.
Or comment on to what end? Yes.
I think one of the what this section is trying to do, and what we all need to work together on, is a couple of principles is to, number one, establish a governance for these CCOs that represents, A, first and foremost, those who have some risk in it, financial risk, B, those that represent the medical community at large that should be a part of this, that's going to come together to share in the care of the Oregon Health Plan population. And the third is some representation from consumers, and exactly how that's worded in the appropriate way, I think, needs to be worked out. There are contractual arrangements where some county governments provide some Medicaid services, some which are within the Oregon Health Plan and some which are not. I think what needs to get worked out is how Coordinated Care Organization is able to work with a county government that provides certain pieces of the safety net that indeed Oregon Health Plan patients are part of as well. So an example might be a mental health crisis line, which might be used by individuals on the Oregon Health Plan as well as others, and it certainly might be appropriate to help contract for that piece of a hotline that is used by OHP patients, for example.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
And just one more comment on this area, and I'm sorry I'm coming more from a public health perspective, but that's what I know about. Right now, we are public health.
I submit you know about a lot more than just that.
Public health provides a lot of women's reproductive health, and they get Medicaid dollars, but you have to realize that those Medicaid dollars stretch over and cover maybe 75% of the women who don't have Medicaid. And so it's a sharing. The Medicaid dollars that we are getting is actually paying for a very, 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 very valuable service to low-income women who may not be eligible for Medicaid. So that is an issue on how would we deal with that.
And one of the questions we raised last week, I think, was the whole notion of the relationship between the safety net and Medicaid, and we need to pay attention to mm-hmm. that in more areas than one, I think.
Go ahead.
Chair Greenlick, Senator Moses Anderson, I think the intent in this, and certainly from the CCO perspective, was to make sure that the continuum of care was established for those Medicaid eligibles. This example that you highlighted wouldn't necessarily be part of that CCO continuum. And I think that's where we're trying to figure out what's that right balance with the counties. And it's from the Public Health and Mental Health Authority.
Okay, we're up to Section 5. We only have about 43 more.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I think the challenge for me on page 7 for that section starting on line 25 is that...
We're not on Section 5. Okay, go ahead.
Section 4, sorry. I want to go back to the counties. And because I think we're going to have this continuing issue.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it needs its own section. Because Section 4 is difficult for me because it talks about the CCOs and how they interact with their members, where they're located. And then you have this contractual piece that's kind of just stuck in there. If we want to have a section talking about who the CCOs are contracting with or who they're relating with formally, we either need a standalone section or we just need a section to deal with the county issues. Because I think there's multiple issues, and I wonder if we should just put them in one spot. So, because it comes up in other sections. So.
Yeah, we'll be hearing more about the county. So, he does a question for us.
Here's Mr. Smith.
Section 5.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
One more.
Speak up here.
One more here.
Growl down there.
I understand what Senator Moses Anderson is saying, but I think also we're going to have to be very sensitive to the role of counties in rural areas, because many of them have highly integrated service provisions that are doing exactly what you say. They're getting the budget, and they're using it in creative ways to cover a lot of ground, and if we, without care, pull that back, not only in your example will the rest of women's reproductive health collapse, but perhaps other service areas will also collapse when there are shared resources, not necessarily dollars, but in these integrated systems, it might not be wise to just pull counties out or shove them aside without evaluating what they're doing and the quality of the work they're providing. I'm for counties.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Section 22, which begins on page 35, that's the existing statute about working with counties. And all that does is change it to prepaid managed care health services organizations to CCOs. But for example, on page 36, it still says that they should be working with counties in family planning and maternity case management, school-based clinics, and so forth.
So this the item in 4 foreshadows or adumbrates,
that is correct.
What's
Mr.
coming
Chair.
Later? Oh, yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just raise this as a flag. Lines 20, 21, and 22 on page 7. The use of technology is very, very expensive. And if we write criteria that require some front-end loading, we could be spending a lot of money. And while that is a goal and something to achieve, if it's a part of the specification, it could be a big hurdle.
Section 5, says he, tentatively. Where's Section 6? Section 6. Section 7. Section 8.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
page
sir.
12. I believe this is Section 8.
Sorry?
I believe this is Section 8, page 12. Lines 27 through 31 and on to the next page. Could I ask a few questions about this?
Exactly what I marked.
Yeah. Another key component here.
What does it mean?
I'm not sure what you mean by this, but I think I know what you mean. If you're setting up a coordinated care organization and one of your major partners doesn't want to play, how do you get them to play, whether it be an MCO or a hospital or a county mental health or FCHIP or any other large organization? It could even, in some cases, be in a rural area, a particular physician you absolutely need in that area. The only one does C-section or something like that. So I'm not embellishing a bit here for us. And frankly, I agree with the language. I just want to hear, I want to up front, everyone understands what they're talking about.
Co-chairs, Senator Bates, members of the committee, I think indeed you've hit the intent of that on the head. Whether the language also gets nails it in the same way, I think we all need to talk about. But the intent was to be certain that as we look to put together the whole idea of these coordinated care organizations is to have a single point of accountability for the health and health care of the Medicaid population in an area, and to bring together all of the components of the local healthcare system to work together in a cooperative way so that they're not competing with each other and that they're working towards a common purpose. And this section was meant to bring people together and not, in essence, allow one component of the healthcare system in a community to basically be able to have veto power over the rest of the community getting together to form this kind of an organization.
And Chair Greenlee, Senator Bates, the language that I think we were trying to get at was really more of an entity or an organization, not necessarily just from a provider. More of an entity.
So you're not talking about Doc Bates saying, I don't want to deal with Medicare patients. Mm-hmm. I'm Medicaid patients.
They probably want me out for other reasons, but not in, okay? But let me ask a question a little further for follow-up.
Please.
I envision this a little different way of dealing with this issue, but this is also a good way of doing it. I'll take an example of what I'm most concerned about. You set up a coordinated care organization where you're trying to. The hospital's on board. The physicians are on board. The A&D nonprofits are on board. But the county mental health says, we're not going to play. And so that patient leaving the ER on a Saturday night has the same system it has now, which is non-functional, and you can't get them in there for 3 weeks, and the patient recycles to the ER as they always do. My attitude about that is just cut off the funds to the county for that program. It's primarily flow-through funds, although some counties do put some money into it. The other way to do it is through this program of arbitration. They're both pretty heavy-handed and difficult. My question to LC is, considering the sovereignty of counties and the state, do we have the authority to make those kind of things happen? To me, that's a real question mark.
I can't believe there is the authority to force a hospital, say, into binding arbitration.
I'm asking.
Because they don't want to be a part of it.
Chair Green, like Senator Bates, I have to get back to you on that one.
I mean, one would hope they're all going to come together and work together and kumbaya, all that good stuff, but this could get sticky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It could get particularly sticky if our reimbursement is so low that it puts these organizations at risk.
You suggesting money would be involved in this?
I think money might be involved.
Shocked, Senator. Shocked.
I would also suggest it might get really sticky if the state is telling people what to do.
Right.
Well, the state
that's
is telling
the way
them.
It reads.
Actually, this reads that this was specifically
ACO.
Written to take the state out of it and
okay.
have an independent ACO. Arbitrator outside of the state to be able to help arbitrate that so that the onus wasn't on the agency who might have relationships with many of those different organizations.
An arbitrator hired by who?
Well, we could work on that.
Hired by the authority, so I mean.
Senator Freeman?
I get the difficulty we're trying to get at here. If everybody won't work together, this isn't going to work. I also get the challenges of forcing people to do something they don't want to do. So I think we'll need to do quite a bit of discussion around this particular section to get it right. But there has to be something in there that compels people. I'm more apt to say the global budget's the global budget, and if you can make it work, you be a part of it. If you don't want to be a part of it, you go about your way. I don't really like the idea of trying to force people into something.
Okay. I have a question above that. I think we've had this discussion before. Item G, line 16 through 18. My understanding in a Medicare Advantage plan, you can force Medicare patients to enroll and stay enrolled for a specific period. Are you suggesting that in this kind of a plan, you don't have the ability to have open enrollment periods, contract periods, that a Medicare, a dual eligible can disenroll any time for any reason?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, right now, if someone is duly eligible by federal law, they cannot be mandated into managed care. And so what this tries to do is set up a situation whereby we're going to ask some federal permission to be able to have being a part of the coordinated care organization the default, and then some opportunities for people to opt out if certain of their needs can't be met, rather than the opposite, which is what happens now, which is we have a lot of individuals who have to enroll themselves. They're not mandated to enroll.
And we're going to define what promptly provides adequate services. I mean, I can't get in on Monday. I can't have to wait till Wednesday. I'm out of here.
We will do our best to define in rule
what that means.
Good. Okay, we have anything else on Section 8? We'll move to Section 9. Section 10.
Mr. Chair. I don't have a suggestion, but healthcare aides doesn't seem quite right for the types of personnel we're looking at, because health, yes, care maybe. I mean, we're talking about paraprofessionals in some ways helping to facilitate use of the system. I just want to put it out there, maybe healthcare aides, and as the title isn't quite right. I don't have another suggestion.
As a generic title for the various things that are specifically.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, these are not part of the law. I just put those in there to guide the reader so you can better get an idea what the paragraph's about. I was thinking aides because they aid the people, the patient, but they're not part of the law.
Thank you.
That's the things underlined as sort of titles are not part of the law.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick,
okay.
That's correct.
Okay. Senator Miles Anderson?
Getting back to quality measures.
Where are we?
Page 13 and in line 15, you know, the authority shall incorporate measures. Actually, in line 10, the Oregon Health Authority, through a public process, shall identify objective outcome and quality measures and benchmarks. What if you miss something? And I'm thinking of drug and alcohol at this point in time. There are programs that are highly more effective than other programs, and probably some programs in the state are located, and bad ones are located all by themselves maybe somewhere. Anyway, this piece is really important to me, and because and I just don't have a handle on how we can, how you, the Oregon Health Authority, can develop these outcomes, and it sure would be nice to have it at least shared with us on what these quality outcomes are.
You did a lot of work in that, went in those Wednesday night sessions at one point to talk about some of these.
Chair Greenlick, Senator, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, this is
you just while I have this, just answer the questions and not go through that rigmarole.
This is one of the areas that's going to need a lot of work, and I think you've outlined the two issues. One is the development of the quality standards that we will hold organizations accountable to. That's going to be key. The other piece is, and I think it alludes to the previous discussion about carrots or sticks, about people coming together to form organizations, is likewise what's going to happen and if organizations don't meet certain quality and outcome standards. And that's going to need to be worked out, and I think comes back to the legislature as we do this work and really becomes part of what we are putting together and will bring back to the legislature as the definition of a CCO and what they're going to be held accountable for, both from a quality standpoint as well as from a budgetary standpoint, and what the consequences of that would be. I think it's a critical issue, and I agree with you, this doesn't get at the kind of detail that I think all of us are going to need to feel comfortable.
But not in statute probably.
Yeah, because I know an MCO is not putting in much in drug and alcohol treatment, and another MCO is actually putting more in alcohol and drug treatment, and they are seeing positive outcomes with the amount of money, and it does take extra money to deal with that. So those are the types of things that sure would be nice to have in.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned Section 10 when I raised my hand, so if I could.
Hmm?
If I could, you had mentioned Section 10 before we went back.
Well,
so
go ahead.
Okay.
We'll come back to Representative Thompson.
Okay, what's a concern I have, because we had talked about over at Willamette the need for, we talked about navigators, you know, basically people to triage people through the system, which I think is an important thing, and a definition of that, and a training level. We also talked about simplification, and we're creating theoretically a whole lot of new sorts of things here, and so we need to be careful. I think maybe we need one sort of thing that can do multiple things. So I'm just looking at all these different terminologies here, and I think we need to go back to our discussions over at Willamette and maybe kind of narrow that down, define the job and the training requirements.
The article that I passed out to you comes from a poverty project I had in 1968 through 72, where we hired essentially community health workers, we call them neighborhood health workers. They went out to help enroll people, bring them in. Then they became personally responsible for making sure they could link with the system. Then they had specific objectives. And this paper talks about simply getting kids immunized. I mean, it's really not that hard to do.
No, and Representative, we were in the same small work group and we had that discussion, if you remember, so, yeah.
I think this is an easy one, actually.
Well, we just don't need to overcomplicate it.
Representative Thompson?
Going back to the quality measure, I'd like to drill down just a little further on what Senator Morris Anderson was saying. One of the problems that we have in these areas, and drug and alcohol is a good example, is identifying what really works and what really doesn't work, and the label drug and alcohol is a mask for a whole lot of things. We have many alcohol programs I think most people would agree are fairly effective, but we have a lousy rate with meth addiction treatment, and that may be an area that we really want to call out, and areas that we recognize poor outcomes and really do some extra work at how, if we're going to spend money on these areas, what are the most effective things we can do in the really troubled areas, and maybe force a little direction. So a lot of meth treatment going on that is ineffective. People are back on the day they leave the program, and that's not money well spent.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Instant best practices.
I think it's important that we remember why we're here in the first place, and this session may not be appropriate. We're here to do more with less. And one of the
topic
things...
Section
10.
Okay.
One of the risks of a new enterprise is to add, and this, I would suggest that a whole new regulatory scheme may not be appropriate.
Mr. Chair,
my recommendation would be a
very interesting question.
Chair, I'm going to ask the section we left in there for kind of a different reason. We actually have, I believe, this workforce in place right now. We just don't recognize it, it's there. Mm-hmm. And we have a huge number of people at probably our highest risk population right now being served by home health care workers 20 to 30 hours a week. And they take care of a lot of their needs, keeping them clean, keeping them fed properly, getting them out to shop. That workforce needs to be trained to do some very simple things that could make a huge difference in people's outcome. Are you taking your medications properly every day? Do you have an appointment with your physician you've forgotten about or don't have a way of getting there? Are you eating properly? That workforce is already in place. It's in a different budget, of course. It doesn't talk to the health care budgets. We don't allow that stuff to happen in this state. We silo everything off. So retraining that group of people, which is already there, will be a way of dealing with this without having to build a new group. Those people are there already. And that's the kind of innovative things I think a coordinated care organization can do. They're going to reach out to home health workers and say, can you start doing these things? Can we get you trained to do these things? We don't have to develop a whole new workforce for that. Let's build the workforce we have now and give them broader opportunities.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that comment, I have met with a number of these health community, these health workers that are providing a lot of care to primarily disabled, but it would be the population that the MCOs, that would be in the CCOs, and they have a passion already for these clients. So I think we need to be very careful about saying we shouldn't use the workforce that is already there.
No, Chair, I was not suggesting that. I was suggesting that we could probably accomplish the same thing without a whole new regulatory scheme, because I agree that those people that are already in the field, they can be trained and they can should be used, but do we need to certify and regulate through the Oregon Health Authority? We're adding cost. We're not doing more with less.
One of the things we talked about on the Wednesday nights was the notion, if we're coming in with 20% less money than we have now, which is maybe even more than that, less than we need, one of the trade-offs is that we reduce some of the regulatory burden rather than increase the regulatory burden as a part of the same thing. And I think that's going to be something we're going to have to balance very carefully, because there's going to be, okay, you put a 5-member team together to give us outcome measures, and you end up paying 5 salaries to get the outcome measures that you'd rather have 5 nurses to deliver care. And I think that's going to be an important balance. We're going to have to give up a little of that moment-to-moment looking over their shoulder to see how they did, I think. I agree with you, Senator Morse. That's important. Okay, Section 11, protected information. Anything on that one? Well, and then we come to Section 12, which I expect some of us have some serious questions about. Well, let me lead off a question.
Just back in regarding independent actuary.
Section 12.
Oh, that is in Section 12. Okay, gotcha.
My understanding is that we are not doing it the way we used to do it, with creating actuarially developed stuff. We are developing a different way to create global budgets based on how much money we have. So this whole Section 12, which was taken, I think, properly from existing legislation, I don't think is where we intend to go. I mean, I think the whole section is wrong. Is that...
Chair Green, like, I think when you look at Section 12, I think the one thing that I think is important, if you look at Section 2, Line 22, where it says the authority shall develop qualification criteria, and then the authority shall present that criteria to the committee. Now, the question really is, how do you want to have that come back? Is it to a committee? Is it to the full assembly? Because on the next line, Section 3 on line 26, we talk about the global budgeting process that, again, is going to have to come back in front of the assembly. And I think both of those two things are very important. We don't want to lose that. But everything behind that, we would say, doesn't have to be there.
I think we need to talk to our leadership in both houses. President Freeman was suggesting, for example, that this committee could carry on through the interim to have special things. I'm not convinced that both leaderships will find that an acceptable model, but if it is, I mean, you're going to have some stuff before we meet in February, right? If you're going to try and meet RFP goals and other things. So I think we need to check in with our bosses and find out what they would like to do with things that need to happen before February. Then there are a set of things that you're going to be preparing for us for February, which would, I assume, come through the normal channel. Senator Monis Anderson?
No.
Thank you. I think it's pretty important that as we look into what happens after we leave here in the session, that the health authority has some sort of a continuity of people to talk to. You know, we have heard people say, well, you come back to the e-board. Well, unless we're the e-board, you know, you'll be talking to a whole new group of people, and this is extremely complicated. You know, the other idea is you could come back in February, and we'll all be here then. But that sure seems to me like it leaves a lot of time for you all to be working possibly in the right direction or possibly in the wrong direction. So that was my only comment about the opportunity to meet with this group in the interim to make sure we're kind of tracking the same direction, recognizing we wouldn't have the authority to make decisions during the interim, but at least you'd have the ability to be communicating with us.
And a follow-up on that comment.
Yes, ma'am.
We are meeting in September and December. I don't know if that's often enough. It would be nice for this. We could make a request to have this committee be scheduled for when we have our other committee.
Say through the interim. Mm-hmm. Maybe you and Senator Morris and Representative Freeman and I could get together with the president and the two leaders and the two speakers and see what their desire would be. Make that a... I sense we would probably like that as a recommendation, that we be carried through in the...
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that this committee stay live, but I would also suggest that we have the ability to meet in between legislative days as the need arises.
Yes,
so,
Senator Morris, is that...
Yes, I was going to move on to a different...
Okay.
Same section.
I'll take the lead in asking for it on behalf of the others and see if we can get some clarity, because I think you do need a home in the interim. And that could take some of this stuff out of here. It could simplify what we're doing here. Okay. Yes.
Oh, Senator Morse.
I still have something on section 12, if I may.
Okay. No, it's good.
We have spent essentially
weeks. Hey, there's a ton of stuff in here.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff. We have spent essentially weeks going through a process of developing the assumptions for a redesigned delivery system. But yet we have not modeled that. There's no way that we have tested yet. And I'd like to see somehow some language in here that even though you are not able to create one model that fits all areas and regions of the state, at least some way that you could look at this in an analytical way and then work on making sure that it does fit. Because we're jumping out of the plane and hoping the parachute opens. And I'm
hoping
sure
we have a parachute.
I'm not sure we have a parachute on. So
remember, the plane's getting ready to crash, too. Okay.
Well, I'd rather plan it rather than have it be an accident. But anyway, that's just a concern. That there's a lot of assumptions that this, in fact, will be a working scheme.
There is a section I meant to ask you all whether you like, which talks about, I don't remember which section it is, but it talks about staying where we are while we're moving towards something else and allowing plans to merge as they develop. I think I read that in here. Is that your sense of it, or do you think we ought to be jumping out of the plane all at the same time in that, in the context that Senator Morris was... I didn't mean to make you look nervous.
No,
is a question.
Chair Green, I was just trying to actually understand the question, and I think what we'd like to do is have some agreement about what the criteria are for the organizations as well as for the budgets, but I think understand that it may be at different time frames that communities start to move forward.
That's
into
the question.
Those. And
in the meantime, you stay with what's in place.
That's exactly
there, as it. And I think that's what you were suggesting, and we have a chance to look at those different models that emerge. And they will be different. Mm-hmm. There's no question. Yes, ma'am, Representative Kotak.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a little awkward to ask the agency about this section because I'm not sure this is necessarily their language. I think we need to get the global budgeting part right. I was very comfortable with the discussion at the Wednesday night meetings about clarifying that the health authority with the health policy board would go, come up with the criteria, and come back, not only for the qualification criteria for the CCOs, but also how the global budget would be arranged. I'm highly uncomfortable with the language in here trying to set something, and I would not want to see much of this language go forward other than some of the smaller parts that you've mentioned.
And Representative Cota, I think if you look at where all that starts at the bottom of page 15, that all is contingent. If you look at line 28, it starts there by saying, until a global budgeting process is approved. This, all, page 16, 17, that's what's being mirrored. And what we're saying is that that's not necessary if you link the global budgeting approval process and the CCO criteria approval. They've got to go hand in hand. And then all of that is irrelevant.
I was going to ask whether you maybe have some, you've been thinking about this global budgeting thing. Do you have some tentative language that you think might be a good substitute? I mean, take out this until and give us some guidance and statute that you would like to.
I think what we've talked in terms of, if you look at line 26, the authority shall develop a global budgeting process. The authority shall present the process to the Legislative Assembly. I mean, that's as pretty straightforward as we can get right now.
And the next section, doing it as we do it now, and take everything else out of this section.
The one thing that we would take until that global budget process is approved and the criteria that we would extend the existing contract.
Well, you don't need to put anything about criteria. You say doing it as you're doing it now, which this
right.
Well, I think the challenge with this is this somehow assumes some interim organizations, and
that's right.
I don't think that's what we had envisioned.
That's right.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yes.
I hate to keep beating this, but if there was some way to identify an early adopter, and they exist, an early adopter, but if we had the broad scope of criteria that they could present back to us, because they're going to have to model it. They're going to have to go through this exercise, the financial part of it, in terms of service delivery, who's doing what, cost, and all those things. We might get the benefit of an early adopter that would model how this thing would work and how we would craft that into the legislation to allow for that to happen at an early stage, because I know there are organizations that have been meeting this morning, and they're working like crazy to be responsive to this. So that might be helpful for us to allow that to happen.
Thank you. One of the things I liked when we saw the timeline out of the Wednesday night meeting was that we weren't all around the state going to start exactly the same date. Matter of fact, if we envision that, I think that would be extremely problematic. So to some extent, I think what we're trying to get at here, or what the drafters were trying to get at here, was what do we do in between? So as long as we establish that the criteria for the coordinated care organization and the global budget are matched at the same time, and we stick with what we have until we start something new, it seems to me like that's the appropriate way to approach this, and recognizing that we're not going to all do it on the same day, and that there is going to be communities around the state that are ready to go much sooner than others, which I think really is the best thing, because it lets us sort of transition in and learn from best practices and all those things that we're trying to do here. So I get the wording here is kind of muddied up, but I think the intent is well intended.
Exactly what we had wanted, and I think the issue that Senator Morse brings up and what we can hopefully work together to figure out is how you can have someone go earlier if indeed there's a legislative sign-off that may not happen until February. And I think it's been a timing issue. And our sense is that in probably the really best of all worlds, and it would be a lot of work, would be sometime in the fall to be able to have developed the criteria, as well as we have to remember we're going to need to get the federal approval to implement that as well. And so I think that's the sooner the better. It's trying to link that to an early adopter legislative sign-off and understanding different communities are going to be different. Try and let those who want to come early, and those who are going to take a little bit more time to transition to be able to have that time.
Maybe we could suggest we serve as a sort of special subcommittee to the E-Board
and that we make recommendations to the E-Board for final, for their final decisions, because we obviously don't have the authority to make decisions. The E-Board might, if the, we can explore that with the office.
Or we could be live at legislative days, because we are. Mr. Chair, you know, during legislative days, the Senate usually convenes, we have confirmations, that there might be possible that we could actually go live during the legislative days and actually be able to take action.
The House couldn't.
Yes, you could. You could call yourself in.
Oh, I'll try that on our speaker.
Well, I
tell me how that goes,
Mr. Chair, as an alternative, but I would also suggest there's a mountain full of stuff that has to be defined here before you even approach CMS for a waiver, and so knowing the way CMS usually operates, you know, this isn't going to happen next week. So I think we've got time, and we can see how we're progressing and see if there's action we need to take. But it's not going to be this month, and everybody knows that. So,
okay, let's keep going. I would propose we keep trying to go through this for hours. I know that's what Senator Monta Sanderson wants to do, so let's try going. I'd like to ask a question at the end of this section 12. On 16. Lines.
What page?
It will be page 18, lines 9 through the end of the section. It's section 5. It's the one that was left out of the one we had before, but is in the one we got tonight. So we're now in two different volumes. The one we're looking, it's in the section dated 4/20/11.
Oh. Okay.
Well, they were on the table here, right?
Is that right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were they?
Yes.
All right. Yeah.
This is the newest one, right?
And now change, yeah, the only thing that's different is in this section, but it changes the line numbers. So if we could, if it's possible, we need to switch to the new one, I think.
420.
I think that's what we're using.
Some were, and some were using the prior one. The one we're looking at on page 18, line 9, is a subsection 5. This was one that was accidentally left out of the earlier version. Is that right, Lori?
Contracts of the dental.
To allow a period of transition, the renewed contracts with dental organizations until 2014, and the A and B hospital section, the rural hospitals. Could you help us understand that? Is that
sure, Chair Greenlink? I think you know the intent really is to you know help create as much as possible some transition and some bridge into the CCO. And I think you know for many organizations, the idea of just flipping a switch and going from where we currently are into that model. You know, certainly has a lot of risk. And I think the idea was, you know, what this language actually looks like and what that bridge looks like, I think still would be discussed, but this is kind of a starting point in terms of, you know, some of those organizations' concerns.
So a CCO, in this case, contracting with a A and B hospital would have to assume, in spite of what reimbursement they had in their global budget, that they would have to reimburse the A and B hospital for full cost.
That's right.
The global budget to recognize that.
Oh, so you'd put money into the global budget to do that. Is that your sense?
Yeah. Well, I think the global budget would need to recognize that that was going to be a piece that was paid from that budget. That's clear.
Okay. Anything else on 12?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I read it that way. I mean, you're going to hire and retain an independent actuary to review the viability of rural hospital participation, which that means to me that you could be talking about modification of reimbursement.
You think the intent of that language, and this is a section that I think needs some further work, was after 2014, was to look at how whether or not any changes to rural hospital reimbursement really would in any way interfere with viability of some of the critical access hospitals. So that, I think, needs a fair amount of work. It was to say, until 2014, paid as currently are, after 2014, we need to have a process that has some independent look at how the hospitals get paid to assure that we don't, in some way, inadvertently cause some irreparable harm to those that can't financially absorb that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the section above it, whatever that is, sub 4, starting on line 5, page 18, I don't quite understand this section. If there are current managed care organizations that meet the criteria, I certainly think they would make good CCOs. The question is this somehow, I don't get the amending contracts. They don't want a new contract? What's going on here?
I think that's part of the piece that we talked about before, that someone who meets the criteria will be able to become a CCO.
I think that's what's we're trying to get at on line 7 there.
To me, it reads like a preference for existing prepaid managed care plans. And I want to know if that's what we're talking about. I think if you meet the criteria, that's one thing, but this seems to, I'm not sure why we have this in here. I guess
I think the idea behind that is that if you have an MCO today, mm-hmm. that would meet the criteria, then that you wouldn't have to go through a new contracting piece, that you could actually just amend that contract to make it conform to the CCO.
So if there is a managed care plan today that is essentially a CCO under the criteria, that they would just... I just didn't know there were any examples of such, because we're asking for some different things, and so...
Any examples of existing MCOs that are CCOs? I would say no.
Right.
No, I mean, they're going to have to meet those criteria.
I think this was trying to actually get at more of a technical piece, if I read it the right way, which is that if we already had a contract in place with an organization that then could meet the criteria of a CCO, that contract would be amended. A new organization would need a new contract, if that makes sense.
No, it actually doesn't. But
okay. Well, that's what I was asking.
On the same topic, at some point, as we look towards trying to solve the, and I know this is not about the budget, but it's about the budget, to solve the hole we have in the budget, and then what's designed through this process to save the amount of money in the governor's budget that it's designed to save, I think to the extent we can talk about early adopters or early savings, I think that's important. I don't know if this is driving at that or not, but it seems to me like if you've got people in place that are ready to go, and whether they're MCOs or just other people you have contracts with, having the ability to adjust those contracts and get going is important. So I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at here, but... And I'm sorry, I'm getting off the policy bit onto the budget a little bit, but I am very anxious about the amount of money that could possibly be saved through this process, and I think the sooner we start attempting to save it, the sooner we're going to know whether it's going to work or not.
Senator Bates and then Representative Thompson.
I think Representative Freeman actually pretty well summed it up. This allows, frankly, allows MCOs not to have to go through an RFP process, which in itself could take a year, and allows them to go directly become early adopters and take this on. Many MCOs have bits and pieces of this. They might have a relationship with it in alcohol and drug. They may have a relationship with mental health. I don't think any of them have a complete look at this, but it's possible for them to very quickly expand out. They've got the billing procedures in place. They've got the infrastructure to do that. Probably more likely in some regional areas. It's going to be easier for them to do that. Those are their partners already. They can work with them. I'm thinking of Roseburg and Southern Oregon, or places on the coast. Might be a little more difficult in the Tri-County area. But to allow those early adopters to get started immediately and for the savings we're talking about is vitally important. So I think that's what this language speaks to, and it makes sense to me. If you don't, you're not going to be able to break those contracts and move forward. You're going to be stuck when those contracts run out, do an RFP, go through that whole process, and by the time you get through with it, we're going to be 2 years down the line.
Representative Thompson?
I'm having a little bit of difficulty with this section, seeing how we could roll an MCO into a CCO without a great deal of problem with how do we get at the competition angle. If there is no competition because they are what they are, and we aren't going to look at alternate arrangements, we're not going to reduce costs. If we just say whatever you're doing now is great, keep doing it. There's going to have to be, if we can't do an RFP process, at least some way to make sure we're getting the maximum benefit for our dollar. And the other piece I'm a little concerned about is the MCO situations that are not now connected to county mental health and public health programs, and how we would get that connection if we just renewed the contract. There's got to be some way to coerce them to get involved in the community care county piece or whatever else. But if we, you know, if we're looking at a ground up re-delivery of health care, and then we just offer a contract to somebody who's doing it now, there's got to be a way of redoing that contract in such a way that it takes in all of the other territory, including cost containment, that this speaks to me of, if you're doing it okay now, just keep doing it, we'll sign you up. I'd want to see a little bit more, let's get our sharp pencils out and sit down with everybody who's a stakeholder and make sure you still fit before we go down that road.
Yep. Representative Thompson, I think the way we've been interpreting this is that this really calls out the need for developing that criteria for the CCOs and really having, you know, that oversight and that approval from legislative body. Because as we were just saying, there's really no MCO today that could jump into that CCO role. And I think the point that you brought up on competition is fair. And I think that kind of gets to, is it a first come, first serve? If you meet these criteria, then you're in, or you know, how do we want to approach that? But I think we've certainly had a lot of discussion on that.
Representative Freeman?
Well, I think this is our first point where we really get to the heart of the fact that there's urban areas where there could be lots of competition, and there's rural areas that we may have a very difficult time getting CCOs to want to provide the service. I think this also gets at the fact that we're very concerned that we have enough regulation and enough sense of what we're doing that we feel comfortable, but also allowing enough flexibility for this to even happen. And then finally, when we talk about sharpening the pencil, I don't want to scare anybody, we're going to sharpen the pencil.
Yeah.
We're only going to fund so much. So the idea that this contract would be amended at the same payment as what we're currently doing is not going to happen. So I like the idea that, you know, if these people will be willing to come together as a coordinated care organization, and I don't mean just the MCOs, I mean all the people that are required to have one, and say, hey, we can do this with the less money, but we provide a mechanism for them to start doing that. But we are gonna sharpen the pencil.
I'd like to suggest we look at on line on page 20, line 6 through 9, section just before, if we're on the other, just before section 15. It's a very interesting statement, and it says the authority shall adopt rules and execute contracts with coordinated care organizations as soon as practicable, after receipt of the necessary federal approvals, and they proceed for implementation in stages, which I agree with, according to the availability of funding. Yeah. For the life of me, I can't figure out what that means. We have as much money as we have. So, I mean, the notion is, well, we get lots of dollars, we'll fund three of them, and then we get some more dollars, we'll fund three more. The fact is, I think it just say, for implementation in stages, because I think I just heard Representative Freeman say, we got as much money as we got.
is that what I heard?
Well, the co-chairs give us less. We do, yeah.
So I think that's a thing to call out as an important point.
Chair Greenlick, I would also call out, since you just brought that up, what we've been trying to get across on line 8 would be, you know, receipt of necessary federal and legislative approval. Just making sure we're clear on that.
Yeah. Not a bad idea. Okay.
We know where we are.
You have to see it in this room anyway. You don't have to stay in the middle of the building. It's a different story. Section 15.
No, actually, can we just have back on page 18 again? Can I get a explanation of why we would continue to contract with our DCOs until the 1st of January of 2014? What if we have some DCOs or, I don't know, some enterprising dental providers who want to be involved in their local CCO? I wouldn't want to preclude them. So
there actually was some language we had worked on which didn't make it in here that talked about exactly that. That this didn't preclude people from doing this sooner for exactly that reason.
And is there something particular about the oral health arena that we're concerned about, that we'd be doing it this way?
In terms of not wanting to move sooner?
Yeah.
Well, I think it gets back to, I think many may want to look at some sort of bridge and transition, but I think there are some that do want to move, and we want to make sure that language is in there. And I would also say that language was in there in the original piece on B, dealing with the rural hospitals, that we want the same provision in there, that you may have some that may want to move sooner.
Thank you.
Where is this, Mr. Chair?
It's the one I raised before. It's on page 18. It's in 5. It's in line, page 18 in the new version, in line, section 5. This section was left out of the old version in error. So it's on line 9 through, it's actually 9 through 19, 9 through 18.
Okay.
Section 5. It's both the rural hospital piece and the dental. Okay. On to section 15. Anything on section 15? Anything on section 16?
Shouldn't be.
They can be rolling now.
Well, yeah, we got past the bold black stuff. It gets easier then.
Yeah, section
now.
On section 17, on definitions.
Mr. Chair, on that definition around alternative payment methodology, I had a comment from the previous section where, not to take us back, but I just want to clarify. On
where are you?
So we're on page 23, but if we could look back on page 9 on section 5. It says the Oregon Health Authority shall establish alternative payment methodologies, including global budgets. I don't necessarily think of a global budget as an alternative payment methodology when you look at this definition. I mean, I see these alternative payment methodologies under a global budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to know if I'm interpreting that incorrectly. I just want to make sure we're consistent.
This is for reimbursing for service inside the CCO, I think, at this place.
Well, just in a previous section, we referred to a global budget as an alternative payment methodology, and I don't think that's true necessarily.
Correct. What this does, and I think this is one of those sections we need to get some work on, which is it was the intent that the health authority would establish the global budget, but in terms of the innovative payment and alternate ways to pay things within those coordinated care organizations, it was the intent to have those organizations have the flexibility to develop those alternative payments, and not to have us prescribe to them how to pay. That in many ways defeats much of the whole purpose of bringing together all of the pieces of the healthcare delivery system to talk about how to get the resources to where it does the most good.
Thank you. Thanks for the clarification.
Okay, other.
Center beat.
Quick comment.
Yes,
question.
Please.
Thanks. Page 24, line 6, shared savings arrangements. When you talk about global budgeting, you know, there's two ways of looking at this. One is that these aren't really global budgets. You know, cost shift can occur if you set rates too low to the commercial market. So we have to remember this is the global budget for Medicaid. Then you talk about shared savings. You know, no good deed in this business often goes unrewarded. And what happens here, if we're not really careful on the global budgeting, is a coordinated care organization put something together that's really working well. They brought costs down. Where does that cost saving go? Because if it doesn't stay in that organization, you got two problems. One, the organization itself may not be able to continue the way it wants to. And those organizations or states, or I shouldn't say counties or areas that have not done this, have not gone for a coordinated care organization, then we'll be siphoning money out of the budget to continue where they're at. There's no incentives. This is a very big carrot right here. And how this is set up and how it's done through rule is very important. It may be one of the most important things we're talking about. So you say shared savings, is that within the budget? Did some of it come back to the state? There are questions here.
I think two different angles to that, and I think they're both critical, and you're absolutely right. One is how within an organization different providers share in the savings. That's one piece, and that's critical. I think that the second piece is also a very critical piece to the global budgeting, which is that if we're going to have organizations that are going to become more cost-effective, they can't be penalized as they go out into the future for being more and more cost-effective. And in essence, those who aren't as innovative and as cost-effective rewarded. And we need to work on that. And I think that's part of how we put together a global budget, also not just simply within a 1 or 2 year time frame, but how you look at this at getting the policy objectives for the state out over a period of time.
Yeah, it's an issue of how do you share negative savings.
Yeah.
That's easy.
Leave it to you, Mr. Chair, to strike it in a way that I just vaguely understand. Okay, but I know what you're saying, and I think we all agree in this. We've seen these things happen over and over again. And the state of Oregon itself is a good example of that and how we get reimbursed for Medicare. We did a great job with Medicare 25, 30 years ago, and we've been constantly penalized for that. As other states have driven up their costs and got paid more, and we've held our costs down and get paid less. So that's an issue we want to be aware of. That's all.
Senator Freeman?
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Backing up, and I hate to do this, Section 15, page 21.
Oh, I have something with 31.
I know. We're going to get right back there. This is quick. I think I understand it. So Section 3, the very top of the page, talks about convening groups. You called out health insurance companies, health care centers, hospitals, or other health service corporations. Am I assuming that's meant to be like some of the people you have contracts with, the DCOs, MCOs, those type of folks? And for some reason you didn't specify them by name, but are they included in that, or what are we thinking?
I've assumed that, but I'd look to Lori.
Chairs and Representative Freeman, this is just to protect in case the authority brings all these businesses together to try to collaborate so that they're not subject to antitrust laws.
But it's to be broad, not narrow.
Right, but it would include, I mean, that section that says other health service corporations would include all those other groups if you wanted to have them at the table. So they're not excluded, they're included.
Co-chairs, Representative Freeman, that's correct.
Great, thank you. Back to 31.
Back to 31. Section 19. Comments on 19? Well, how about Section 20? Representative Freeman?
I'll make a comment or two. Thank you. Again, as we're looking towards a cost savings, Section 21 and Section 22 could have the unintended consequence of driving up cost, specifically in 22, the collective bargaining portion. So I think we'd want to take a serious look at that and see what the collective bargaining has done for the home health care worker population and cost, and what projections it may have as we look at some of the recent law passed for the development of disability care workers, and kind of evaluate if that's really where we want to go, and if there's a better way to get at that.
Other comments on?
Mr. Chair.
This is a convoluted question. How is it in a bill relating to health we can have collective bargaining but we can't have tort reform? There's some other sections in there the same way. I just have a real problem with that relating to health. Relating to health care might work, but I think we're way out in left field on some of this stuff. And adding to that, I don't think any discussion of collective bargaining has any place in a health care bill. If these workers want to unionize, that's fine. They can just go unionize or jump off a cliff or anything they want to do. But I think when we're putting language in a health care bill about what's obviously unionization, that's not appropriate.
Counselor, do you want to comment on the relevance? Is that the word?
Co-chairs, Representative Thompson, when I chose relating to health, I was trying to make it as broad as possible.
Oh, yeah. You did.
And I believe these do fit within the title because we're talking about healthcare workers as components of the healthcare workforce, and they're going to be participating in the coordinated care organizations.
So let's stipulate it's relevant whether we want to have it in or not.
Physicians don't qualify? I said physicians don't qualify. They're part of these organizations.
Physicians are health workers?
I would believe they are.
That's right. The commission.
Yeah.
I think we're going to organize.
Yeah, what I'm saying is let's stipulate it's okay to talk about these workers, whether we want to have it in or we don't want to have it in. But let's not get too hung up at this point as whether it fits into the relating clause.
I think I'm hung up on this one.
Talk to us, Senator Cruz.
If collective bargaining fits because we're dealing with health care workers, then liability protection dealing with health care workers should fit as well.
There you go. So you have two options. We can opt to take this out, or we can opt to put the other one in and see what our council will accept it.
Yes, ma'am.
I think one of the important parts of what we're trying to do here is, and you know, the workforce piece, you know, it's going to be critical to make sure that we have some standards and some ways to incorporate a set of paraprofessionals, community health workers, navigators into this system and protect them in a way that will help them be a stable and sustainable functioning part of this new system. We currently really don't have that set up, and I think this is an attempt. Now, you might not agree with the attempt, but I think we have to take that seriously. Is if we're going to achieve these goals, and we assume we're going to do with the existing healthcare professionals out there, I would submit that has not worked. We need a set of folks that are represented as community health workers, navigators, the peer health wellness, the peer wellness folks, if we're going to make this work. And I think we heard that last week when we had the Central Oregon folks here about the effectiveness of having that set of new professionals out there making this work. So if you don't agree with this, I think we have to think about ways to protect that burgeoning workforce in a way that they can actually sustainably make this work over time.
Senator Morris.
What happens if you have an organization, a CCO, that feels it's best to have these people as employed in that organization? This absolutely steers all of those related workers to the commission as their employer. And that may not be the model that, that really works. And I, you know, I question whether that should be in the, that we should be steering that in statute.
Yeah, I think that's a more important question than the collective bargaining question. Mm-hmm. The notion that you would have workers inside your organization who you don't employ. I have some concern on the collective bargaining side, but this one causes me more problem. And I've had this conversation with some of the proponents of this section. I just don't think you can manage an organization in this context. On the other hand, I think the career ladder from being the kind of home care workers that we have now who really are in the home and do a lot into a career ladder like this, I think is very important. And the question, I mean, I think these are, if we can find a way to move these folks up the career chain and create permanent jobs for them with training, that seems to me a very important thing to do, and it seems to me probably the most expeditious way to get to this, to the workforce we need here. So I think it's going to be something in the balance of these issues. I think that's what Representative Kotek was saying as well. Senator Bates.
I'm going to echo a bit of what you said. 10-12 years ago, when we first looked at this workforce, it was a revolving door. The average length of time someone worked was about 90 days because the pay was low, there were no benefits, and it was a constant battle to find home health care workers. You know, you may agree or disagree with this chapter or this section, but it is stabilizing the workforce. We are starting to get an improvement in quality of our workers, and it has an opportunity for them to do just what you said, move up the chain. I would say, however, though, if this falls underneath the relating clause, I would tell you that I think malpractice reform, tort reform, is much more germane than this is. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an attorney. I'm certainly not a judge. And I defer to you in all things along these ways. But this one time I may have to ask, I don't follow why tort reform's out and collective bargaining is in. I have a real problem with that. And I appreciate that being brought forward by Representative Thompson. I don't get it. I mean, one directly drives health care costs. It makes a question about availability, the number of physicians. We're marked as a red state. A lot of physicians will not come here because of our tort situation. And if you haven't got a workforce of physicians, I just don't get it. So I'll leave it there.
Well, rather than putting you on the spot right here, can we ask you if you would go back and reconsider this, check in with your colleagues, and see if you can get an argument that convinces us. I think what I hear Laurie saying is that when we get into the malpractice area, whatever we do is likely to be litigated. And one of the vulnerabilities of litigation is that there's a bill that the courts could argue wasn't appropriate in that bill. That means we go through the trouble of trying to figure out a risk management model and then end up having it thrown out, not on the basis of its content, but on the basis of what bill it is. Is that what I heard you say? Is that the...
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Okay. We have some issue about what to do with this session. I know this set of sections, I know an issue. I'm not sure where we go to try and deal with them, but...
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that we are going to request the stakeholders out there, and I think it's extremely important for MCOs, for providers, stakeholders, to take a look at the workforce that is going to be needed in a coordinated care organization. And so I think it's going to be very helpful for us to get input from the stakeholders, and this might help us make our decision.
Thank you. I was hoping to get us through this one time, and if the time is holding up, we all started pretty early. Should we set a time on this? You go till 8?
I'm running out of gas, Mr. Chair.
Make it to 8?
I can make it to 8.
All right, let's go. Let's see if we can move.
We're only have about 10 more pages before we get to conforming amendments. So.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
Let's make that the cutoff point then for tonight. When we get the conforming amendments, we can all take a look at them separately.
4-8.
Huh?
4-8.
4-8.
Yeah, I've got a...
Whichever first occurs.
Yeah, because we thought we were done just a minute ago. So.
I'm going to take a chair's prerogative and move through this, which we know is a problem, and get to the next section, which is 24. Did I miss 24?
23, I think
you're at.
Missed 20.
23, the collective bargaining?
Yeah, 23 is ombudsman, but I don't...
Okay. How about 24 on contracts? Has some heartburn with 24. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I don't want to jump back, but we did say we...
Jump back.
Bruce, that we were going to kind of rework the county section, right? Okay. So I won't really dig into that, which is section 22. So there'll be a rewrite of that. So
will you have some language that you would like in that to give to us?
Can you share language?
The county relationship on, or should we just keep working in the regular way?
I think keep working in the regular way.
Okay. So that's an issue we need to put on our agenda.
Yes.
We can ask the county folks to talk to us on it. We ask the MCOs to talk to us on it.
Okay. Sorry to go back, but...
Yeah, I had the same thing.
Okay.
Is that whole section on page...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Something like 36.
36 and 37, yeah.
Yeah. Section 22.
Right, 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 right.
Section 22 turns into... I had some notes on that one, too. Anything else? Can we go to 23?
Mr. Chair. And
what page?
Under section 24, page 40, lines 5, 6, 7, and 8. Again... I think we should be...
I'm sorry, what page is that?
Page 40.
40, thank you.
We need to have reporting for financial results included.
Yeah, I think that's in a previous part of this section.
On page 39.
Previous page on 39 talks about reserves, but... doesn't get at your issue, which was all the transparency of reporting.
Yes.
Operating financial statements and audited year-end financial statements,
right.
I think are absolutely essential.
Question about that, too.
Senator Freeman.
I agree it's important that we are tracking the dollars. I would like to have a little bit of a dialogue at some point around whether it's the authority that does this or DCBS and really the relationship there and how we would look at that.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering along those lines if at some point in time we have kind of a random or scheduled Secretary of State audit as well.
A random or...
Or scheduled, not every year, but kind of a scheduled Secretary of State audit as well, so we have an outside look.
Senator Otto. Yeah. We ought to talk about whether we want audits, whether we want them to have their auditors, or both.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
On page 40, starting on line 5, where we talk about timely submission of outcome and quality data, I just want to put something on the parking lot for people to think about. How are we going to hold them accountable?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when in other federal programs, for example, when we would do quality control in the food stamp program and we didn't meet certain benchmarks, we would get penalties. So I just want to put that out there as something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
You also got rewards, too.
And rewards. Well. If you hit them, you got rewards. That's right. Bonus dollars, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I just want to point out that with respect to the question about regulation by DCBS or the Oregon Health Authority, This maintains the current structure where the authority does the regulation. And if you look on page 41, lines 25 through 27, this is current language, says it's not considered to be the transaction of insurance for the purposes of the insurance code. So that would have to be changed if you wanted to change the regulation over to DCBS.
I don't think we see this as insurance in the usual context. And we're not worrying about them giving us rates and approving them or not. We're talking how much money we have for them.
But, Mr. Chair, to have an outside set of eyes.
That's the point I was trying to drive at, is just so we have the ability to make sure whatever measurements we're doing, nothing against the folks living in Health Authority, but it just seemed to me like, and maybe they're not the right organization, but it seemed like it's one we trust to do a lot of other stuff. So
we've talked about that exact piece.
Well, I mean, the notion is we're talking about a global budget, and we're talking about handing them a global budget. We're not talking about them coming into with a rate increase that
the solvency
issues is what I was talking about. Yeah, the evaluating the.
That's a different issue. Yeah, absolutely.
That's good.
Okay, I think I'm at. Where am I? Section 26. Anything on 26? 27. Here's where we get the patient-centered primary care home stuff. It actually looked unusually clear to me.
See if I can muddy it up. Chair?
Yes, sir.
So when we talk to the extent practical, so in some rural communities of Oregon where we are fortunate to have a doctor hang a shingle outside of his house and see people, that's what we're talking about. They're not going to be able to have this elaborate structure in place. We want to leave that as...
Correct.
This allows for that?
Yes.
Okay.
They may not have some of the resources that are available in other areas to incorporate.
That is a patient-centered primary care home.
I guess... maybe that wasn't
maybe
a good,
maybe
that wasn't
best
a good
guy.
Example. Maybe it's the guy in the back of his van that I'm worried about. So.
Section 29 looks like it's a boilerplate about money. Where to hide the money, is that what that is? So. Section 30, page 42. I like this one. A coordinated care organization and one that meets the criteria established. That's a good one. Section 31.
Conforming amendments.
Conforming amendments.
Correct, conforming amendments. Well, let me ask a question about conforming amendments. There are some... How did you decide which ones to leave in? I mean, there's some that... stuff. There are some things in there that actually seem to me to have some policy implications to it by leaving in or leaving out. Is that...
Mr. Chair, I...
You have every amendment that's related.
If they
have
a policy implication, then I would move them forward, and I welcome your comments on that. Most of these are either where we amended a statute so it had renumbering, and so we had to amend the cross-reference, or just changing from prepaid managed care health services organization to coordinated care organization.
Lori, that was another question I had. You delete all references to prepaid managed care organizations, but they're not going away yet. I mean, how do you make sure that... I mean, if we pass this thing today, it would seem to me there'd be no such thing as prepaid managed care organizations, which we need to have in order to keep doing what we're doing. Do you have some sense... Bruce, do you have some sense of that? I mean... Do we get into a problem by... We don't need the whole thing the same, the mirror that keeps them in until we don't need them anymore, but...
No, that's fair.
Do you lose your ability to do it when we're...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that is a problem with, the conversion. And in an earlier draft, I had left the operative date blank. But, I mean, that's one way we can do it, is create a, have a delayed operative date for the changes in those sections. But it is difficult. And I tried to address it to some extent on page 71, lines 8 to 11, again, sort of mirroring that earlier language about, you know, as soon as they can convert to the coordinated care organizations, they should do so. But it is a problem with the way the thing's structured.
You can't put in a section that says until 2014, everything that refers to managed care organizations can still be operative, even though you've deleted them from the statutes or something? It seems to be complicated. You have two sets of laws, a completely different...
I agree.
I mean, I think the notion was we want to give time to transition, but you also don't want, if we've decided this is the direction that we're moving, that we then operate parallel systems for some period of time.
But you're going to have to.
Well, I think the question is where and if you call an end. And then there's an additional question which we have to grapple with, which is those parts of the state where there may not be the ability, there may be neither what was the previous managed care structure to the a new coordinated care organization.
Well, I don't think you want to wipe out all references to how you relate to managed care organizations while you still have to relate to managed care organizations. That could be a little bit of a problem. So you may want to, as well as thinking back whether medical malpractice is a health issue to them, also get your war council together and ask about, I would hate to have to redo the whole thing.
That is your call. That is the committee's call.
Well, I think on the substantive answer, we do not want to eliminate their ability to deal with managed care organizations.
So we can either have two parallel sets of statutes and have one be repealed some date in the future where you want it to happen, or the way it's structured now is that they enter into them as they can, and we try to keep whatever remnants in there that we need to. For example, it leaves references to prepaid managed care health services organizations for collecting liens on against personal injury settlements and things, you know, that may carry over into the future. But it's really up to the committee to decide when you want that conversion to happen. Or maybe if not at all, then we need to go to two parallel sets of statutes.
Mr. Chair, there may be a relatively simple solution here. If the effective date was changed to March 1st of 2012, and both Section 57 and Section 58 will have met, and we can make the decision then.
But I'm not sure it's a decision. I mean, what I think is going to happen is you're going to want both of them going at the same time.
But, Mr. Chair, the point I'm making is we will be in session, and we can decide what needs to continue and what doesn't at that point. I mean, just a suggestion.
Yeah,
it's delaying the operative date 2 months, but it allows the legislative session to convene before that happens.
But we don't want to start thinking about whether we need to create two parallel sets of bills then. It would be nice if there was a simple way to deal with it, but maybe it's too complex a problem to be dealing with simply.
Sure. Thank you. My guess is there's lots of people listening, and that there's lots of smart people that might come up with a solution for this. It seems like we're getting hung up on names, and I get that's the contractual part of the name that we're worried about, but I think we know where we're going and we know where we are, so somehow we got to figure out how to transition that. So maybe after a few hours of sleep, we might come up with the right answer.
We know where we're going.
Representative Freeman, another is that we could include both references, sort of like we did with the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. I mean, some of the statutes would be problematic for because they're really focused on the CCOs, but that might be, I mean, we could maybe do some sort of hybrid of that.
These are two different effective dates in two different sections. You do that neatly.
Yeah, well, then we would probably have triple amends on things.
Okay, here's where I think we are, and if my co-chairs can... And see, we're, Rick will give us, a report sometime during the week on what it is we've noted. We're going to expect either a new bill on malpractice or a sense that it's okay to amend this one. We'll share proposals for malpractice suggestions among us. And we'll start taking next week is Senator Montes Anderson's turn. She'll be giving us suggestions.
Nope. Representative Freeman.
Oh, are you next? Oh, yes, Representative Freeman's next.
Boy, girl.
If you'll be giving us suggestions on public testimony.
We're going to talk about the amendment piece. I think it's pretty important. I think there's lots of folks out there that are excited about entering amendments, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the co-chairs agreed on funneling those amendments through the administrator.
Yeah, conceptual amendments rather than actual amendments.
Yeah, and I know LC is very excited about having the what you're trying to change. Don't try to write the words for them. And we'll funnel that stuff through Rick and to LC.
But we want to set a date certain for this first draft.
That's right.
We want them in by when did we, what date did we decide?
Thank you, Chair. We put out an email message, and there's some slips of paper in the back there asking everybody to please no later than 9 o'clock tomorrow morning get written comments in. They may be quick and high level.
Tomorrow morning?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You want to review them on Friday?
We need them
a little time to aggregate them.
That's
no,
you've got the rest of the night.
9 o'clock tomorrow morning is next one.
Or as soon as possible.
I would give them lots of time. 9 o'clock Friday morning, it seems to me.
We won't be able to go over on Friday morning.
We won't be able to go over on Friday morning, but I don't see how you can ask somebody to do something by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
We've already got some.
I have full faith in our co-chairs to review these by Friday morning, so we can stay on track.
But if they could get the comments to me
as soon as possible.
As soon as possible. And just to address it by section number, state problem and recommendations, and then email them to me. My email address is on that slip of paper and on our website.
Well, we co-chairs meet every Friday morning, and so we need to give our administrator time to organize all of your amendments. Maybe we'll only have one or two, so it'll be easy. But it is important. We have a very short timeline, and I think most of you have been very involved in the Wednesday night meetings, and you really can know what you want in the bill for your particular organization. So I don't think it's unreasonable to get your comments in so that we can go over the draft of Friday morning. So.
Right.
We may have to change our meeting then.
Oh, okay. I think you all know what we've picked up as things that we're looking at. I would say, and if you, Mike or Bruce, have some specific language on things we've talked about that you think you want to feed into the process that helps clarify what your intent is, that would also be very welcome. And co-chairs, anything else?
Is the intent for next week to go over the amendments? That could take a while. Or are we having public testimony?
I know what we had talked about. This is sort of an evolving process.
I'm not sure what we.
It's important for us we co-chairs will determine what we think is reasonable or not for our caucuses and for our committee. I, in particular, once we have the amendments, am definitely going to go over them with all of my senators.
Except for one.
I had a different opinion last time. I continue to have it. I think we need to have those discussions in public. And I think we need to... I think this is the place to I think we should narrow things down, and I think we should put them in a sort of memo to our group, and we ought to talk about them here.
Not what we're called. No.
I don't have a problem with that. I'm just saying that I am going to take time to make sure I understand where my senators are coming from.
Senator, I don't... If I could clarify, Senator, I don't think there's quorum issues if the senators all meet and the House members all meet. It's only if you have a quorum of House and Senate members together.
So all of us could meet.
Okay, I had told that it could only be four, but if it's five, that's cool.
You guys can hang out and talk all
day. They just tell you that because they don't want you at the meeting.
That's why they told me I can't meet with them.
We use that trick on our side too.
That's how he does the trick. All I would say is, it would seem to me the set that we agree is a sort of, here's a set of issues we ought to be discussing here. That's the point. You want to discuss it beforehand? That's fine.
We have to decide what to put into amendments, because I think it's so hard for the public to be able to give feedback if we don't have it in amendment form. So we are going to be making decisions, the co-chairs, on what we like and what we don't like. And then if you want to discuss every single one of them, that may be what we end up doing.
I think we should be making some decisions about the relevant ones, and then I think we ought to bring those issues before the whole committee, and that's what we ought to be talking about as a committee. And if we need more than 2.5 hours, then I think maybe we start later, have time for dinner, and go 3 hours. But I think this is a really important issue. I think we need to have these discussions in public, not in private. And that's the thing I said in the
both.
First.
We need to do both.
Mm-hmm.
Having settled into that firm agreement. We're adjourned.